This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin. Talking to Strangers, written and read by Malcolm Gladwell.
Talking to Strangers, what we should know about the people we don't know. For Graham Gladwell, 1934 to 2017. What you are about to hear is a different kind of audiobook. This is a book about strangers and what it means to understand them. And so I thought it did not make sense to follow the standard practice of just reading my words into a microphone. Instead, whenever possible, when I quote someone, I'll let you hear their words in their voice. When I talk about something that happened in the news, whenever possible, I'll let you hear directly what happened. Think of this as an audiobook with the polish of a well-produced podcast, like my own revisionist history, to name just one example. Talking to Strangers also has a theme song. Janelle Monáe's Hell You Tom Out. I was almost finished with my book when I first heard that song, and I thought, I cannot publish Talking to Strangers without it. And so it appears throughout, and I think it sets the tone and theme perfectly, as you will hear. Thank you to Janelle Monáe and her team for lending their music to my words. Introduction. Step out of the car. In July 2015, a young African-American woman named Sandra Bland drove from her hometown of Chicago to a little town an hour west of Houston. She was interviewing for a job at Prairie View A&M University, a school she'd graduated from a few years before. She was tall and striking, with a personality to match. She belonged to the Sigma Gamma Rho sorority in college and played in the marching band. She volunteered with the seniors group. She regularly posted short, inspirational videos on YouTube under the handle Sandy Speaks. They often began, "Good morning, my beautiful kings and queens."
Good afternoon, my kings and queens. I am up today just praising God, thanking His name. Definitely thanking Him. Not just because it's my birthday, but thanking Him for growth, thanking Him for the different things that He has done in my life over this past year. But just looking back at the 28 years that I've been on this earth and all that He has shown me, even though I've made some mistakes, I have definitely messed up. He still loved me. And I want to let my kings and queens know out there that He still loves you too.
Bland got the job at Prairie View. She was elated. Her plan was to get a master's degree in political science on the side. On the afternoon of July 10th, she left the university to get groceries. As she made a right turn onto the highway that rings the Prairie View campus, she was pulled over by a state trooper. His name was Brian Insignia. He was a white man wearing the trooper's wide-brimmed hat and sunglasses. He was courteous, at least at first. He told her that she had failed to signal a lane change. He asked her questions. She answered them. Then Bland lit a cigarette, and Insignia asked her to put it out. Their subsequent interaction was recorded by the video camera on Insignia's dashboard and has been viewed, in one form or another, several million times on YouTube.
I'm in my car, but I have to put out my cigarette.
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car. Step out of the car.
No, you don't have the right.
Step out of the car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I do have the right. Now step out or I will remove you.
I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I am getting removed for a failure.
Step out or I will remove you. I'm giving you a lawful order.
Bland says she will call her lawyer. Insignia reaches into the car and says to her, "I'll yank you out of here." Glenn tells him not to touch her and says she's not under arrest. He shouts that she is under arrest. At this point, Sandra Bland starts to record things with her cell phone.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket.
I said,
for failure?
Get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You just I'm giving you a lawful order. You just I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're going to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car! Right.
And then you
I will light
me?
You up. Get out!
Wow.
Now!
Insignia has pointed his taser at Bland. She gets out of the car, but keeps recording.
Wow.
Get out of the car!
Really for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get over
signal.
There.
Right, yeah. Yeah, let's take this to court.
Go ahead.
A few seconds later, Bland turns off her phone as Insignia orders her to do. She was arrested and jailed. 3 days later, she committed suicide in her cell. The Sandra Bland case came in the middle of a strange interlude in American public life. The interlude began in the late summer of 2014. When an 18-year-old black man named Michael Brown was shot to death by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. He had just, allegedly, shoplifted a pack of cigars from a convenience store. The next several years saw one high-profile case after another involving police violence against black people. There were riots and protests around the country. A civil rights movement, Black Lives Matter, was born. For a time, this was what Americans talked about. Perhaps you remember some of the names of those in the news. In Baltimore, a young black man named Freddie Gray was arrested for carrying a pocket knife and fell into a coma in the back of a police van. In Minneapolis, a young black man named Philando Castile was pulled over by a police officer and inexplicably shot 7 times after handing over his proof of insurance. In New York City, a black man named Eric Garner was approached by a group of police officers on suspicion that he was illegally selling cigarettes and was choked to death in the ensuing struggle. In North Charleston, South Carolina, a black man named Walter Scott was stopped for a non-functioning taillight. He ran from his car and was shot to death from behind by a white police officer. Scott was killed on April 4, 2015. Sandra Bland gave him his own episode of Sandy Speaks.
Good afternoon, my beautiful kings and queens. I am not a racist. I grew up in Villa Park, Illinois, was the only black girl on an all-white cheerleading squad, so I had to learn how to deal with. And black people, you will not be successful in this world until you learn how to work with white people. But I want the white folks to really understand out there, black people are truly, we're doing as much as we can. And we can't help but get pissed off when we see situations where it's clear the black life didn't matter. For those of you questioning why was he running away, well, goddamn. Because in the news that we've seen as of late, you could stand there, surrender to the cops, and still be killed.
3 months later, she too was dead. Talking to Strangers is an attempt to understand what really happened by the side of the highway that day in rural Texas. Why write a book about a traffic stop gone awry? Because the debate spawned by that string of cases was deeply unsatisfying. One side made the discussion about racism, looking down at the case from 10,000 feet. The other side examined each detail of each case with a magnifying glass. What was the police officer like? What did he do precisely? One side saw a forest, but no trees. The other side saw trees and no forest. Each side was right in its own way. Prejudice and incompetence go a long way towards explaining social dysfunction in the United States. But what do you do with either of these diagnoses, aside from vowing in full earnestness to try harder next time? There are bad cops. There are biased cops. Conservatives prefer the former explanation. Liberals, the latter. In the end, the two sides canceled each other out. Police officers still kill people in the United States, but those deaths no longer command the news. I suspect that you may have had to pause for a moment to remember who Sandra Bland was. We put aside those controversies after a decent interval and moved on to other things. I don't want to move on to other things. In the 16th century, there were close to 70 wars involving the nations and states of Europe. The Danes fought the Swedes. The Poles fought the Teutonic Knights. The Ottomans fought the Venetians. The Spanish fought the French, and on and on. If there was a pattern to the endless conflict, it was that battles overwhelmingly involved neighbors. You fought the person directly across the border, who had always been directly across your border. Or you fought someone inside your own borders. The Ottoman War of 1509 was between two brothers. Throughout the majority of human history, encounters, hostile or otherwise, were rarely between strangers. The people you met and fought often believed in the same God as you, built their buildings and organized their cities in the same way you did, fought their wars with the same weapons, according to the same rules. But the 16th century's bloodiest conflict fit none of those patterns. When the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes met the Aztec ruler Montezuma II, neither side knew anything about the other at all. Cortes landed in Mexico in February of 1519 and slowly made his way inland, advancing on the Aztec capital. When he and his army arrived, they were in awe. Tenochtitlan was an extraordinary sight, far larger and more impressive than any of the cities Cortes and his men would have known back in Spain. It was a city on an island, linked to the mainland with bridges and crossed by canals. It had grand boulevards, elaborate aqueducts, thriving marketplaces, temples built in brilliant white stucco, public gardens, and even a zoo. It was spotlessly clean, which to someone raised in the filth of medieval European cities would have seemed almost miraculous. When we saw so many cities and villages built in the water and other great towns on dry land, we were amazed and said it was like the enchantments, one of Cortez's officers recalled. And some of our soldiers even asked whether the things that we saw were not a dream. I do not know how to describe it, seeing things as we did that had never been heard of or seen before, not even dreamed about. The Spanish were greeted at the gates by an assembly of Aztec chiefs, then taken to Montezuma. He was a figure of almost surreal grandeur, carried on a litter embroidered with gold and silver and festooned with flowers and precious stones. One of his courtiers advanced before the procession, sweeping the ground. Cortes dismounted from his horse. Montezuma was lowered from his litter. Cortes, like the Spaniard he was, moved to embrace the Aztec leader, only to be restrained by Montezuma's attendants. No one embraced Montezuma. Instead, the two men bowed to each other. "Art thou not he? Art thou Montezuma?" Montezuma answered, "Yes, I am he." No European had ever set foot in Mexico. No Aztec had ever met a European. Cortes knew nothing about the Aztecs except to be in awe of their wealth and the extraordinary city they had built. Montezuma knew nothing of Cortes except that he had approached the Aztec kingdom with great audacity, armed with strange weapons and large, mysterious animals, horses, that the Aztecs had never seen before. Is it any wonder why the meeting between Cortes and Montezuma has fascinated historians for so many centuries? That moment, 500 years ago, when explorers began traveling across oceans and undertaking bold expeditions in previously unknown territory, an entirely new kind of encounter emerged. Cortes and Montezuma wanted to have a conversation, even though they knew nothing about the other. When Cortes asked Montezuma, "Art thou he?" he didn't say those words directly. Cortes spoke only Spanish. He had to bring two translators with him. One was an Indian woman named Malinche, who had been captured by the Spanish some months before. She knew the Aztec language Nahuatl and Mayan, the language of the Mexican territory where Cortes had begun his journey. Cortes also had with him a Spanish priest named Geronimo del Aguilar, who had been shipwrecked in the Yucatan and learned Mayan during his sojourn there. So Cortes spoke to Aguilar in Spanish. Aguilar translated into Mayan for Malinche, and Malinche translated the Mayan into Nahuatl for Montezuma. And when Montezuma replied, "Yes, I am," the long translation chain ran in reverse. the kind of easy face-to-face interaction that each had lived with his entire life had suddenly become hopelessly complicated. Cortez was taken to one of Montezuma's palaces, a place that Aguilar described later as having innumerable rooms inside, antechambers, splendid halls, mattresses of large cloaks, pillows of leather and tree fiber, and admirable white fur robes. After dinner, Montezuma rejoined Cortez and his men and gave a speech. Immediately, the confusion began. The way the Spanish interpreted Montezuma's remarks, the Aztec king was making an astonishing concession. He believed Cortez to be a god, the fulfillment of an ancient prophecy that said an exiled deity would one day return from the east. And he was, as a result, surrendering to Cortez. You can imagine Cortez's reaction. This magnificent city was now effectively his. But is that really what Montezuma meant? Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs, had a reverential mode. A royal figure such as Montezuma would speak in a kind of code, according to a cultural tradition in which the powerful projected their status through an elaborate false humility. The word in Nahuatl for a noble, the historian Matthew Restall points out, is all but identical to the word for child. When a ruler such as Montezuma spoke of himself as small and weak, in other words, he was actually subtly drawing attention to the fact that he was esteemed and powerful. The impossibility of adequately translating such language is obvious, Restall writes. The speaker was often obliged to say the opposite of what he really meant. True meaning was embedded in the use of reverential language. Stripped of these nuances in translation and distorted through the use of multiple interpreters, not only was it unlikely that a speech such as Montezuma's would be accurately understood, but it was probable that its meaning would be turned upside down. In that case, Montezuma's speech was not his surrender. It was his acceptance of a Spanish surrender. You probably remember from high school history how the encounter between Cortez and Montezuma ended. Montezuma was taken hostage by Cortez, then murdered. The two sides went to war. As many as 20 million Aztecs perished, either directly at the hands of the Spanish or indirectly from the diseases they had brought with them. Tenochtitlan was destroyed. Cortez's foray into Mexico ushered in the era of catastrophic colonial expansion. And it also introduced a new and distinctly modern pattern of social interaction. Today, we are now thrown into contact all the time with people whose assumptions, perspectives, and backgrounds are different from our own. The modern world is not two brothers feuding for control of the Ottoman Empire. It is Cortez and Montezuma struggling to understand each other through multiple layers of translators. Talking to strangers is about why we are so bad at that act of translation. Each of the chapters that follows is devoted to understanding a different aspect of the stranger problem. You will have heard of many of the examples. They're taken from the news. At Stanford University in Northern California, a first-year student named Brock Turner meets a woman at a party, and by the end of the evening, he is in police custody. At Pennsylvania State University, the former assistant coach of the school's football team, Jerry Sandusky, is found guilty of pedophilia, and the president of the school and two of his top aides are found to be complicit in his crimes. You will hear about a spy who went years undetected at the highest levels of the Pentagon, about the man who brought down hedge fund manager Bernie Madoff, about the false conviction of the American exchange student Amanda Knox, and about the suicide of the poet Sylvia Plath. In all of these cases, the parties involved relied on a set of strategies to translate another's words and intentions. And in each case, something went very wrong. In talking to strangers, I want to understand those strategies, analyze them, critique them, figure out where they came from, find out how to fix them. At the end of the book, I will come back to Sandra Bland because there is something about the encounter by the side of the road that ought to haunt us. Think about how hard it was. Sandra Bland was not someone Brian and Sinia knew from the neighborhood or down the street. That would have been easy. Sandy, how are you? Be a little more careful next time. Instead, you have Bland from Chicago and Insinia from Texas. One a man and the other a woman. One white and one black. One a police officer and one a civilian. One armed and the other unarmed. They were strangers to each other. If we were more thoughtful as a society, if we were willing to engage in some soul-searching about how we approach and make sense of strangers, Sandra Bland would not have ended up dead in a Texas jail cell. But to start, I have two questions, two puzzles about strangers, beginning with a story told by a man named Florentino Aspiaga years ago in a German debriefing room.